But take just a moment as we begin this morning. Take a deep breath and just sort of get centered, relaxed. Let's realize together again the powerful meaning of the Spirit of God working in each one of us. Let's emphasize that idea of working. God's Spirit works in us. Jesus says, the Father works and I work. So let's keep that in mind as we realize the powerful meaning of the Spirit. I give thanks for the Spirit of God working in my life together. I give thanks for the Spirit of God working in my life. And that work is a work of wholeness, of inspiration, meaning, and purpose. And we're grateful, Father, as we share in that purpose today. Amen. Okay. We're going to spend a little more time now with Phineas Quimby in about half of this hour, and then we're going to pick up Mary Baker Eddy and spend the rest of the time with Mary Baker Eddy and Emma Curtis Hopkins. I think we'll be able to do some things with Hopkins too. We're talking about Quimby's method and his way of working with people. And just before we go to his religious development, which is the fourth period of his life, let's look at this little thing on Quimby as a lawyer just for a moment. You should have it in your handout sheet. Part of your handouts. And did anybody read this? Anybody have a chance to read it? What is he trying to get at in this whole idea? Do you have any idea where he's going with this? You didn't quite get the whole picture of it, huh? Okay. Anybody else?
It's a little bit hard to follow his analog.
Yeah.
He sort of wanders off in different directions.
Well, let me point out what he's trying to do, and we'll just look at several sections. When he gets going in his writing, he gets rather involved. He says, if you understand how disease originates, then you stand to the patient as a lawyer does to a criminal who is to be tried for a crime committed against a law that he is ignorant of breaking. And the evidence is his own confession. What Quimby sees here is that he, Quimby, as the healer, or as the one who comes into the picture, is the lawyer. And he's taking the case for the accused. And the accused is who? The person, right. And the person is accused of committing a crime, or a crime committed against a law that he is ignorant of breaking. I kind of like that. He's not sure what it is that, what law that he has actually broken here, but the evidence is his own confession. You know that he is innocent, but you can get no evidence. Only by cross-questioning the evidence against him. Disease has its attending counsel as well as truth or health, and to cure the sick is to show to the judge or their own counsel that the witness lies. Where are all these characters? They're inside, you see. The judge is an aspect. The judge is within them and eventually will hand down a judgment in the case, but Quimby sees the process of healing as taking the case for the patient, arguing the case, and showing to that the witness lies. The witness is what in the patient?
The illness.
The illness, sure, and the beliefs that the patient has about the illness. He's showing that the witness is incorrect. Disease has its attending counsel, so there's a lawyer for the disease, you see, that's arguing the case too. And I think it's a kind of interesting imagery because it's the same imagery that Paul uses, interestingly enough, in the New Testament. It isn't only Paul takes the view that a person is justified, justification in the biblical, the New Testament biblical sense, is the same thing as getting the patient, in this case, in Quimby's view, getting the case for the patient. To be justified is to be made right in Christ, as Paul would say, and it's a legal term. It's a term that was used in the legal profession of the time that Paul was writing. Excuse me. And what you've got here is a similar image. He says, the error is on one side and you on the other, and out of the mouth of the sick comes the witness. And then he's going to state a case. And when you read through the case, that's where you get confused. But now skip down to near the end, where he says, about two-thirds of the way down, then I take up the evidence and show that there is not one word of wisdom in all that has been said. Also, that she has been made to believe a lie that she might be condemned. What does that say about illness in Quimby's view and healing? That in order to get healed, you've got to show, in his terms at least, that one view is wrong and the other view is right, you see, and that healing has a wisdom that the illness does not have. In this way, he says, I get the case. And that's his view. That's his purpose, you see, is to get the case for the patient, for the accused. So he argues the case, and you see him almost arguing with the patient, in one sense, which he probably did. He probably was so vociferous in some instances that that it appeared that he was arguing with the patient, but he isn't. He's arguing with the view or the attitude within the patient that would justify the disease. Disease being made by a belief or forced upon us by our parents or public opinion, and this is important to understand in Quimby. On the one hand, opinions stand over against wisdom. And you'll see this again and again in the manuscripts. The opinions of individuals are nowhere near a match for wisdom. Wisdom is something you get in the clairvoyant state. You get in when you get still and you get down below that level of in which the mind is running its own course, and you allow the mind to get in touch with its deepest wisdom, then you come to know the truth. It's a very simple kind of view that he has. In this way, I get the case. Oh, we already read that. Therefore, it requires, I think I read that previous one. Therefore, it requires great shrewdness to get the better of error. For disease is the work of the devil or error, but error, like its father, has its cloven foot. And if you are as wise as your enemies, you will get the case. I know of no better answer than Jesus gave to his disciples when he sent them forth and told them to preach the truth and cure. Be ye wise as they were, or serpents, and as harmless as doves. That is, do not get into a rage. What's he saying there? Don't get excited or upset or in a rage about this. So he's a different kind of lawyer. He's arguing the case out of a position of wisdom and out of a position of truth, and he is confident, fully confident, in the truth of what he is saying. In this way, you will annoy the disease and get the case. I love that. He's going to annoy the disease. Now, if you can face the error and argue it down, then you can cure the sick. You get the point? And I think that's very typical of Quimby's methodology during this whole period. He's learning to put into terms, into words, into pictures, the kind of relationship that he has with the patient. And the relationship in this case is that of a lawyer to the accused. It's an interesting image. Now I'd like to look at, have we had enough of Quimby's methodology? Are you all fairly clear with how his method works? Primarily, it's a rational method which he uses in relation to the patient, convincing the patient that truth is the truth. The truth of healing, the wholeness, is the truth, and that illness is an error that the person has simply accepted from his parents or from his environment in some way. Therefore, the mind, as it is presently constructed, or as it is presently is, has the capacity, in Quimby's view, to change its opinion, to change its view. So when we say mind can be changed, that's Quimby's basic approach. You change your thinking and you change your world, or you change your life. And of course, that idea gets mediated right down to later New Thought and is at the heart of almost all New Thought teaching. How do you change your mind? What do you do to change your thinking? In Quimby's view, it takes the healer to do that. And this is what we were talking about yesterday, that we have changed our view somewhat in this way, in which we have focused on the idea of, very much as I say, as Coué did, auto-suggestion. In other words, the person learns the truth and can change his thinking through his own efforts. But you don't find that in Quimby. You don't find Quimby suggesting a line of thinking to people and then you go work on it or something like that. Another thing you don't find in Quimby, which is very interesting, is a whole emphasis on prayer. You don't find an emphasis on prayer in Quimby, and we'll see in just a moment in his religious development why that's true. But there's only one or two sections in there on prayer, and primarily he is in those sections, he is rejecting the view of prayer that says that prayer is a beseeching of a God who is somewhere outside of you. So he rejects that view that prayer is a beseeching of God, but he doesn't really tell you what it is in his view. He simply says that is an erroneous view and it's used only to get something for ourselves. And if we would realize that, then we'd realize that prayer in its beseeching form is a selfish kind of approach to life instead of a truly spiritual one. But he doesn't really then sit down and give you a program of prayer or a way of using prayer in healing. And I think that's an interesting thing to observe in Quimby's methodology. Now let's look at his religious development and see what happens here. You find this especially in the chapter on God and man in the manuscripts. I think you have a copy of that, not the whole chapter, but just the beginning sections of it, and we'll make reference to that in a moment. This is the fourth period of his life, from 1859 to 1866. His period of his religious development. I want to read something from page 287 in the manuscripts. You don't have a copy of this. I'll quickly look it up here. On page 287, Quimby says this, "I am accused," and he was probably accused by the so-called priests of his time, "of interfering with the religion of my patients. This is not the case, but if a particular passage in the Bible or some religious belief affects the patient, then I attack it. For instance, a person gets nervous from his belief that he has committed the unpardonable sin." Where would a person get nervous from that belief? What place in the Bible would a person be upset about reading that kind of idea? Anybody know? No, it's in the New Testament. Anybody know? The unpardonable sin. That's right. Jesus' whole business about those of you who would be my disciples cannot blaspheme the Holy Spirit. If you really want to understand what it is I'm teaching, blasphemy of the Holy Spirit is an unpardonable sin, meaning it cannot be forgiven. The only thing is, he turns right around and says, if you stop blaspheming the Holy Spirit, forgiveness, what? Flows right in, yes. And blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, in Jesus' terms, I think, simply means anything you do to reject divine ideas in yourself, or to turn away from the Spirit in yourself and to turn to something else. You see, that's the way we would interpret it. But Quimby noticed that people would read that section and believe exactly what they read there, that if in any way they had ever said some words against God or against the activity of the Spirit, you know, some good old swear words, that did it. You were never going to be forgiven for that. And what do you think people would do with that? They'd make themselves sick. Of course. If you believe that you've done something like that and there's no way to get out of it, he probably saw many people in Puritan New England who had made themselves abundantly sick. And they were in their last stages, and they would come to him, and he would say, how did you understand this to be true? Well, I read the Bible. It says so right there in the Bible, and I've made this incredible error. And Quimby would attack it, as he says. He says, if a particular passage in the Bible or some religious belief affects the patient, then I attack it. He goes on to say, the patient's belief or his thought is then attached to the sin of his belief, and his belief is someone's opinion about a passage in the Bible that he believes applies to his case. I know this is all false, so of course I have to destroy his opinion. He uses those words a lot. He uses words like destroy and attack and fight and this sort of thing. And this destroys the effect which is disease. His senses, that is the patient's, are attached to a disease. Mine are attached to the wisdom that shows the absurdity of the opinion. His wisdom, with a small w, in which he would almost put in quotes, is of man. Mine is of God or science. All disease is the punishment of our belief, either directly or indirectly, and our senses are in our punishments. What is he saying there? We are punished not for our beliefs, but what? By them. You see, it's one of those fundamental ideas that comes right down into unity and new thought. My senses are attached to the wisdom that sees through the opinion, so that my love or wisdom casteth out their disease or fear. And he equates disease with fear. For their fear hath torment, and perfect wisdom casteth out all fear or opinion. It's an interesting relationship, and you can see that he's been reading the Bible, which is, I think, happened probably a lot earlier in his work. He says, I am also accused of opposing the medical faculty and the religious creeds. In answer to this, I plead guilty. Don't you like that? I plead guilty, but you must not gather from this that I oppose goodness or virtue. I oppose all religion based on the opinions of men. And as God never gave an opinion, I am not bound to believe that man's opinions are from God. So you really have this basic fundamental relationship between opinions and wisdom. Wisdom is found in the clairvoyant state. Opinions come to us from folks around us and from the priests and the doctors in particular. And those are the things that make us sick, and we, as we take them on and make pictures out of them, which create a negative view inside. Now let's look at this section on God and man, because I'd like to just read a few things out of this. If you like, it would be helpful, I think, to look at the whole chapter on God and man. Notice what he says, right in the middle of that first page. We have not a true idea of God. God is not a man any more than man is a principle. When we speak of God, we are taught to believe in a person. So we attach our ideas to a person called God, and then talk about his laws, and the violation of them is said to be our trouble. How often we hear these words, if a man would obey all the laws of God, he would never be sick. But the acknowledgement of the error is the cause of 9/10 of our sickness. When God's law is so severe that man is liable to be put into prison for committing an act or even thinking a thought not in accord with the law, it is no wonder people murmur and complain. The Christian's God is a tyrant of the worst kind. Well, that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? He's unhappy with the view that people have of God as a person or a being who would do us in. And so he's going to argue now for another view of God. Over on the top of page 324 there, we're looking at this sheet, this handout sheet. Do you all have a copy of it? Yeah. The time will come, he says, when the true God will be worshipped in spirit and truth. Where did he get that from? Where in the Bible? Does anybody know? What is it? John. It's from the Gospel of John. And in the story of the woman at the well, he speaks of God as spirit. And they that worship him must worship in spirit and truth. At least we know one section of the Bible that Quimby read. For God is a spirit. He also read the King James Version, because that's what it says in the King James Version. In the Revised Standard, it says God is spirit and not a man. Wisdom is the sower and God the vineyard. And as man is made in the image of God, his mind is spirit and receives the seed of wisdom. Down in the next section, man has invented a God according to his belief, so that God is the embodiment of man's belief. As man's belief changes, so his God changes. But the true God never changes. And he's right there with John Calvin, interestingly enough. Do you notice the relationship between Reformation thought and Quimby's ideas here? The true God never changes. He's absolute. The difference is where Quimby locates God. God is not up in the sky somewhere, or off at a distance, or transcendent. Instead, he's very, very close. Let's flip over to the next page, and now the God I worship, right at the bottom of the page, now the God I worship has no fellowship with man's opinions. So to cure the disease is to break in pieces his opinions. This places man on his own, what? Wisdom, independent of man's God or opinions. Then he sees the one living and true God who rewards everyone according to his acts. That's strange. What would you expect him to put there? Beliefs, wouldn't you? Why would he put, who rewards everyone according to his acts and not his beliefs? What is there? What is Quimby trying to get across here? How do you know what it is that you truly, truly believe? By what you do. There's no question about it. If you really want to get a handle on what it is you really believe, because that's what it matters anyway, isn't it? Not what you say you believe. So if you really want to get a handle on real belief, find out what it is that you're willing to do. And then you'll know your acts reflect what your real beliefs are. I think Quimby's really seeing something here. A friend of mine who taught over at St. Paul's School of Theology, Bruce Rotchen, he said, if you really want to know what you believe, take a look at your checkbook and what's how you spend your money, because that's what you really believe, and your date book, how you use your time. And I thought, boy, that's pretty profound. Find out how you use your time and how you use your money, and you'll know 99% of what you really, really believe. And I always thought that was pretty good. He says, to believe in this God is to know ourselves, and that is the religion of Christ. It is Christ in us, not opinions that we are in. See, his point here is that it's so easy to have opinions and to think that they are belief. To think that they are, well, they are belief, but to think that they are the substance and the heart of what we believe. And what Quimby is simply saying is that what our acts show us to be interested in is what we are truly believing in. Then you get in touch with, you get very close to the true God who rewards, he says, everyone according to his acts. Now, a little bit further down. All nations have a God according to their belief. And he goes on and discusses this. And then he says, there is something that stands at the door and knocks. Right in the middle there, it stands knocking at the door, but it is not recognized as having an identity. So it is mocked at and spit upon and hated and despised by all men. Yet it is always the same, calm and unmoved, sympathizing with its friends. Now, what is it? It is an invisible what? Wisdom, capital W, which never can be seen by the eye of opinion any more than truth can be seen by error. For when the truth comes, the opinion or matter is seen to be the shadow of this light or substance that I call something. He doesn't know what to call it, see? Still, what is it? It is what never has been acknowledged to have an identity. Then what is it that has been admitted but cannot be seen and yet is not acknowledged to have an identity? Can the reader answer? Yes, it is God. And so he's trying to show, I think, that, and I would encourage you to read the whole of this, he's trying to show that what is really God, look over at the last page, page 330. Now, where is this God in whose wisdom I believe? He is in the hearts of what? The people. That's Quimby's basic position. He is not a man, neither has he form. He is neither male nor female. And then he gives you a little illustration there, which is probably more confusing than it is helpful. But his point is that the God that he speaks of is synonymous with this wisdom that is at the heart of every person that you discover in the clairvoyant state. And I think we need to say, just to make sure that this is clear, that the clairvoyant state, in Quimby's understanding, is really what we mean in unity by the silence, by the meditative state that you get into when you drop your attention down below that busy, busy level of consciousness to that awareness in which you get very, very still and let the wisdom do what? Speak to you, right, from within. And this is that level. Now, he never has a program for this. That is, he doesn't get us caught up in understanding this and then saying, now go and practice this. Instead, people remain somewhat dependent upon Quimby because they have to keep coming back to him again and again for his treatments. And his treatments, while they follow this basic line, allow him to tune into the wisdom and communicate that wisdom to the patient through him, but not to let the patient tune into the wisdom. And that's an interesting stage, I think, in the development of new thought ideas. Any questions about this and what Quimby, how Quimby understands God? Yes. Yes. Oh, I'm sure they are. Yes, I'm sure. By politics, he probably means all of the rhetoric of opinion that comes out of politicians. You see, that would be my guess, that the politician depends on opinions in order to get his work done. Sure, I'm sure that's true. Right off the top of your head, you see, that kind of thing. Sure. So Quimby's view of God is very imminent, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. It's not transcendent. And his whole point is that God resides within the hearts of the people, and you discover that in the clairvoyant state. Now I'd like to take a little time for an introduction to Mary Baker Eddy and to the followers of Quimby, because here we're going to see how new thought begins to develop in a number of different areas. I hope that you've seen that in Quimby's view, there's a very simple idea here that if you change your thinking, you change your world. And of course, it takes a great deal of, as he says, a great deal of cleverness to get the better of negative thinking. And so his methods of healing are for that purpose, of helping people get over and around and through the opinions that have kept them trapped in their own thinking. The first student that comes to Quimby, I think we'll take a little time. Well, let me list them first. Warren Felt Evans, I think you're familiar with this from reading Braden. And then the Dressers, Annette Seabury and Julius Dresser. Both Julius Dresser met Annette Seabury when they came to visit Quimby, and they got married, is what it amounted to. And then Mary Baker Glover Patterson Eddie. Make sure you get all those names. Now, when she came to Quimby, she was Mary Baker Glover Patterson. And we'll find out how that happened. But these are the four students who really go on to develop the new thought movement in a very real sense. Warren Felt Evans was the writer who was a Methodist minister and came to visit Quimby, and I was going to bring some material for you on that, and I think I'll go get that in the second hour. And we'll take a little time and put Warren Felt Evans aside for a minute. I want to share some ideas that he has from his exploration of not only Quimby, but Emanuel Swedenborg. We'll spend a little time talking about that. The Dressers came to Quimby. Evans came in 1863. The Dressers came about the same period of time. And Julius Dresser didn't take an interest in doing the healing work, and we'll see how that comes about. Even when Mary Baker Eddy asked him to do so, he refused to do it. And it was only later, about 1880, in that neighborhood, that he and his wife come back to Boston after traveling around the country, and begin to establish a healing work and involve themselves in the groups of people who are interested in New Thought. But it's Mary Baker Eddy who is the force and the energy here. So let's start with her. We'll come back to Patterson, or we'll come back to Evans, I should say, after the break. I want to tell you just a little bit about her life, because I think it's instructive for us to see the kind of experience that some of these folks have. She was born in Bow, New Hampshire, July 16th, 1821. Her father's name was Mark, and her mother's name was Abigail, Mark Baker, and he was a very stern Calvinist, and you know what a stern Calvinist is. He was, according to her, a very unyielding person. Mary wrote about him that his relentless theology emphasized the final judgment day, the peril of endless punishment, and a God devoid of mercy toward unbelievers. It's a pretty stern approach, and you've seen that in some of the Calvinist teaching that we've looked at. In her early life, her health was affected, had to be taken out of school. Most of her education was gained through her own efforts and the help of her brother. Her brother was a graduate of Dartmouth University and later a member of the U.S. Congress, and she wrote many letters to him, and he was very helpful to her. She began to write poetry during that period and had some of it published in some of the papers around New Hampshire area. In 1836, her family moved from Bow to Sanborn Bridge. She was about 15 at that time, and when she was 17, she joined the Congregational Church. You know all about the Congregational Church, don't you? Now, in those days, they didn't have the business of the covenant, as we studied it earlier, but she was required to have certain understandings of the fundamental congregational approach to things. This was in 1839, I guess, that she joined the Congregational Church. About the same time that Quimby was experimenting with mesmerism. Her letters from this period reveal that her friendships were not that many with other folks, and that she spent most of her time reading and writing poetry, and apparently not in very good health. In 1843, she married George Washington Glover. And Mr. Glover was a builder who was building a cathedral in Tahiti. And he lived in Charleston, North Carolina, so they went down there, they moved to North Carolina, and she went, of course, to North Carolina. He went off to Tahiti to build the cathedral, and he died of yellow fever within just a few months after they were married. In 1844, she gave birth to their son, George, and was forced by financial conditions to move back to Massachusetts and to give up her son to a foster home, which she did. And she never saw him very much after that. One or two times, and later when he was fully grown, he came to see her. In 1849, her mother passed, and about that same period of time, she was courted by a young minister. And another suitor who was very interested in her went off to the West Coast, and he died. Her father remarried, and she felt obligated because of her stepmother not to stay at home, so she moved out of the house. She left home. And in 1853, she married a dentist by the name of Patterson, Daniel Patterson. He was also a practicing homeopathic doctor. The problem with Dr. Patterson is that he wasn't a very good businessman, and his income kept decreasing. They kept having to change their circumstances. She was unable to take her son back from the foster home because of their declining financial condition. They kept falling into debt, and then she discovered that he was running around with other women. Interesting? And that made her upset. She continued to experience ill health, and by the time we reach the 1860s, about 8 years later, she is totally incapacitated, unable to move, in a sanitarium where she is on her last legs, and the doctor predicts that she won't have that much longer to live. She writes a letter to her sister trying to get some money to go visit a healer that she's heard about in New Hampshire by the name of Quimby. And her sister, shocked by this request, because here's Mary, a faithful Congregationalist, reports this to her father, and her father disowns her. Now, what kind of a life has she had up to this point?
Terrible.
It's pretty awful, isn't it? Many people would have folded under that kind of experience. She's been disappointed by the death of her first husband and the shenanigans of her present husband. She has lost her son to a foster home. What she does is she writes to her sister for money again for some other purpose, and she uses it to get to Quimby, and she visits him in 1862. She first saw him. And within just a few months, she was as well as she ever was after having been ministered to by Quimby. We find that she goes, she works for Quimby for a while and goes up to Warren, Maine to speak for him and to visit two of his patients. She delivered a public lecture up there on P.P. Quimby's Spiritual Science, Healing Disease as Opposed to Deism or Rochester Rapping Spiritualism. They had long titles for talks in those days, friends. And the whole point is that she's contrasting Quimby's spiritual science to spiritualism, and the whole idea that spiritualism is a valid system. So she's come to see at least the truth of Quimby's system and how it works, and the fact that she knows enough about it to defend it in that talk. I think it's fairly clear. During this whole period, she's struggling to understand Quimby's system of thought. And I think it's fair to say that her main efforts are to relate Quimby's system to something else that is kind of bugging her through this whole period, and that is her own religious orthodoxy. How do they measure transcendent, right? What kind of a God do you have in Quimby's system? Immanent, which is that wisdom, yes. And you have almost a direct kind of contradiction here. That's just one of the struggles that she has during this period, trying to relate Quimby's system to her own religious understanding. Her father dies, leaves Mary nothing in his will. She returned to Lynn, Massachusetts about 1865, 1864, in that neighborhood. And then in 1866, Quimby dies. Can you imagine what that would be like to a woman who had depended upon him all that time? It's not so important at the moment of his death. She writes a beautiful poem. I think Braden had that published, didn't he, in Spirits in Rebellion. There's the poem on the death of P.P. Quimby, which she wrote. And then in February of 1866, she falls on the ice, injures her hip. They carry her into the house, put her in bed. The doctor comes to see her and says, "You're never going to walk again." And at that point, she doesn't have anybody. Do you see? She has no one to depend on. Her mentor, Quimby, has passed on. She writes a letter to Dresser and says, "Would you please take up Mr. Quimby's healing work?" And Dresser says, "I've got other things to do. I have to go off to a business trip out on the West Coast, and I don't have time." So Mary Baker Eddy is left totally at this point in her life without any resource. Who did I say? Her name is Mary Baker Patterson, yes, at this point. And she is, I didn't mean that, but Mary Baker Patterson. And she's left without anybody. The record shows this, and I'll just relate this and then we'll take a break. She is lying in bed. Now, this is according to her account. And there's no reason to doubt this. And there's a Bible on this bedside stand. And she picks it up. And sort of like what you do, you know, when you open, the folks years ago used to open the Bible and go like this, you know, and see what it says. That's sort of what she did. She opened the Bible, and she opened it to Matthew 9, verse 2. This is the story of the men who lowered the paralytic down through the roof of the house when Jesus was there, and the Pharisees challenge him when he says to them says to the man, "Your sins are forgiven." And Jesus says, "Which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or take up your bed and walk?" And he says, "I'll show you." He says, "Take up your bed and walk." And what does the man do? He takes up his bed and walks. And that's what Mary Baker Eddy does. She leaps out of bed, feels better than she ever has, and she says, "It was this incident that showed me a truth that I have never since forgotten and that I've been trying to get across for as long as my ministry has been going. The healing truth dawned upon my sense, and the result was that I rose and dressed myself and ever after was in better health than I had before enjoyed." She claimed that when she turned to the Bible, it dawned upon her, primarily because of her religious orthodox training. I'm going to suggest this. First, what is the view of the Bible it's the authority, isn't it? Why is it the authority? Because that's the place where God speaks. It's God who speaks there. It dawned upon her that God was her life. It didn't depend upon a Quimby or some person to mediate that life to her. The activity of God was present and available right here and now, and God was her life. And I'm going to suggest to you that this is the place where Mary Baker Eddy introduces to metaphysics, the metaphysics of the time, something fantastic. It's unique. She introduces back into the metaphysics of Quimby the transcendent God. Do you see it? The transcendent God who is present, who is the one presence and the one power available to everybody. which means that you're not dependent upon any human agency. Do you get the point? Mm-hmm. The fact that she didn't need anybody, but she simply turned to the Bible, opened it, had the truth dawned upon her soul, and she was able to jump out of bed and be in better health than ever before, meant that the transcendent God had entered into her experience at that moment. Do you get the point? Okay. Turning to God, that's exactly right. The act of opening the Bible is turning to God. That's a very good way to put it. And therefore, she realizes that the transcendent God is primary, is the primary source of healing. It is only in Mary Baker Eddy that we get the Trinity that we're so used to in unity of mind, idea, and what? Expression, right? Be sure to remember that, those of you who are going to take the test. Mind, idea, and expression. It's in Mary Baker Eddy that we have this fundamental Trinity. What I'd like to suggest to you is that Quimby is dealing primarily with this part of it. You see here? Quimby is dealing with this part of it here. Mary Baker Eddy introduces the all-knowing mind in which we live, move, and have our being. And there is a difference then between Eddy's system, or Patterson's system at this point, and Quimby. And I think it's important to see that. Now I think we ought to stop, and we'll take a break. Okay, let's go back and pick up the thread of the story of Mary Baker Eddy. And at some point I'll digress, and we'll go take a look at Warren Felt Evans in our process here. After this great experience of Mary Baker Eddy's, of what she called her revelation, this is the way she put it. And I really think that if we take the theological concern here as we should take it, that is, the difference between a Mary Baker Eddy and a Phineas Quimby is a theological one. Do you see it? The issues of the nature of God and the nature of man are very prominent in the relationship between Eddy's thought and Quimby's thought. Both are valid. Can I emphasize that point? But they're different. In Mary Baker Eddy's emphasis, you have, as I say, this emphasis upon the transcendent aspect of God and the effort to integrate this new thought, if you will, this new idea that Quimby had developed, that if you change your thinking, you can change your world. If you change your thinking, you can change your health, your state of health, to something better. To integrate that with her Christianity. And this Quimby had not done, you see. Quimby had simply had a very practical approach toward the understanding of how a changed mind also expressed in a changed set of affairs or a changed body. And her problem was, the problem she struggled with was, how do you come to change your mind? You see, do you argue yourself into it? Which is what Quimby had been doing, basically, and he was the primary one who had the inspiration to make that argument. But for her, there had to be a larger perspective. You had to place this thing under the umbrella of God Himself, so that you change your mind by accepting the fact, in her terms, of the transforming power of God present in every person.
Would
yes.
You say that, or could you say that Mary Baker Eddy gave Quimby's theory spirit?
Spirit.
Divinity.
That's a good way to put it. She brought the whole theological dimension into it in a much deeper way, expressing a view that the way you really change your thinking, the way you change the idea and the expression so that it reflects the true nature of God is by first going back to God. And that has to be done in a transcendent sense, you see. God is the one presence and the one power in the universe. And there is no other. Now, I'm going to suggest something here, and I wonder if you've noticed it in your travels around through the New Thought religious groups and in understanding, perhaps from your own experience in Unity churches and New Thought churches, that you've got two views here which are still with us. You have some New Thought churches that are primarily focused right here. Change your thinking and you change your world. Change the idea and you change your expression. And the minister's role is to get up there every Sunday morning and get you going on that. And that can be very inspiring and it can be very enthusiastic, but you got to keep going back. There's nothing wrong with that. I think that's a good idea to have a time of worship. I think that's very important. But when that role is understood only in terms, the minister's role is understood only in terms of this, you have less of a, the word you used, spiritual orientation, and much more of a simple sort of practical change your thinking and you change your life view of things. And there are many churches that focus on that view. There are others which have included this higher, this other dimension. I won't call it higher necessarily, but the other dimension of mind, idea, and expression. And this is the, I think it's important to observe that depending on the minister's theological orientation, you may get one or the other of those. Catherine would understand this because she and I are friends, and Catherine Ponder, she would find much of her ministry down here. Do you notice that? If you've got all these laws of being and laws of mind, and if you apply those laws faithfully and with the right amount of will and determination, you can become prosperous. It's true. It's absolutely true. It works. But with Mary Baker Eddy, you have the introduction of this other dimension, the which embraces the orthodox view that God is a power that has the capacity to surprise us. You see, that when my energies are at a low ebb and I am out of ideas and there isn't any further for me to go in terms of my own efforts, then I can turn it over to God. And that's the transcendent aspect. And I think that's where Mary Baker Eddy's coming from in her whole emphasis upon this idea that she's had this revelation and it's entirely different from Quimby's view. Now, what happens is that she tends from this point on, from about 1866 on, to slowly but surely pull away from Mr. Quimby and to divorce herself, if you'll let me use that term, from association with Quimby, because she's come to see, at least in her mind at least, that this is a more limited way of expressing the truth. That it's not until you include the transcendent God and find that integration of the two together, the transcendent God and the power of man's mind, so that man's mind is ultimately subject to the mind of God, that you really get a full freeing kind of system. That would be her view. Because what it does is to set you free to, now you see, this is where prayer comes into the picture. Now Mary Baker Eddy introduces a whole system of prayer in which prayer becomes significant in the relationship between man and God, opening up the individual to the mind of God in the silence, it's still the same, you still have the a similar, you still have the use of clairvoyance, only she doesn't call it clairvoyance because that's a term that comes out of the old mesmerist practice, but now she calls it the silence, that's all. But it's the same basic state of a person's inner life. Well, in 1866, right after this experience, she and Patterson separate permanently, and it isn't too many years before they have, before she's obtained a divorce from him. It's interesting about his life. He goes off, and his conditions get less and less, and he dies in the poorhouse in 1896 without a penny to his name. Whereas Mary Baker Eddy went on to create a system of a religious system which met her needs for the rest of her life. It's an interesting kind of experience that she goes through. One of the things that Mary Baker Eddy began to do in this period was to gather students around her and to teach them. And once she began to see the difference between Quimby's system and hers, or at least the what had been revealed to her, she created a series of lessons, which she, about, there were 12 lessons, and she taught them to interested students. Now, some of the accusations that were set forth against her were that she charged $300 for a series of these lessons, and apparently there were enough people. Now, you know, $300 in 1867 or 8 or 9, along in that period when she was starting to develop these ideas, was quite a bit, and it may have been the life savings of some people. But she gathered students around her, and they were very zealous and enthusiastic, apparently, many of them. But one of the experiences she had was that they tended to fall away after a while. They started out with accepting her basic view of mind, idea, and expression, and the transcendent aspect of God's relationship to man. But they almost all, or at least many of them, tended to slip down and forget this part and include only this part. She had a young man who got interested in her teachings by the name of Kennedy, Richard Kennedy. It's a good name to have if you're from Massachusetts, right? And he got taken with her work and enthusiastic about her ideas, and she was enthusiastic about his enthusiasm and felt that he was getting the teachings pretty well, and so she went into business with him in the in an upper room above a store that was on the lower floor. And the picture goes like this. She's in the back room looking out through the door that's cracked open, watching him as he works with the patients and writing furiously on her writings, which later will become Science and Health, and later with Keys to the Scriptures, which she publishes in 1875. And he's out there doing the healing work. And one day, he looks out through the door, or she looks out through the door, and she sees him working with a patient and passing his hands over the patient like this. She raises herself up, charges out the door, and literally kicks him down the stairs, apparently. Yes?
What was that name of that
man? Richard Kennedy. Yeah. And she... this was repeated again and again with various students, the same kind of scenario where she gets disappointed in them and eventually has to reject them or to get rid of them, mainly because of their confusion about this fundamental idea that she's trying to get across. Numerous situations take place like this in the latter part of the 19th century as she's developing her movement. And it's very instructive to read some of the literature that has been written about this period, because most of the people that wrote negatively about her were her former students who had been kicked down the stairs, you see, and had not been accepted. And she attributed all this to something that she called malicious animal magnetism. And this is a phrase that is used. It comes right out of the mesmerist tradition, the mesmerist literature. Animal magnetism was the evil, as far as she was concerned, and it only dealt with this, you see, with the human ability or effort to change the person. And with malicious animal magnetism, you could do more harm, in her mind at least, than good. And we'll take a look at a piece of her writing in just a moment here. In 1877, after she had published her work, Science and Health, which, by the way, I have an original copy of, Science and Health, published in 1875. It's very interesting to dig into this. What you discover when you start reading the original version is that there's one Quimbyism after another all the way through. She's still using Quimby terminology, and in a number of cases in this volume, she'll say things like, "And I got the case," when she successfully healed somebody, which certainly indicates that she had read Quimby's writings, or at least talked with him a great deal. In 1877, she married Asa Gilbert Eddy, a young sewing machine salesman, and she found that in Mr. Eddy, she had the first student who really understood what she was trying to get across. So she married him. That's a logical thing to do. And she, during this latter period, she often went into court to defend her interests against those that she felt were trying to do her in. And of course, when they tried to do her in, they were doing it with malicious animal magnetism. She again experienced some ill health, and there's a very interesting little passage in one of her writings where, to ward off attacks which she believed to be behind her pain, she surrounded herself with persons who were expected to be at her call day and night to ward off the attack, and they would surround her to ward off the malicious animal magnetism that was coming from all around. It's an interesting thing that some of her ideas tend to degenerate into a kind of fear of the human element, because one of the major ideas in Christian Science is the idea of the opposition between matter and spirit. Spirit and matter are totally opposed to one another, and as a matter of fact, matter does not exist. It is non-existent. And therefore, to get caught up in that which would be material would be the exact opposite of what a person should do. She died in 1910 of pneumonia. A very interesting lady, I'd say a great lady, a person who contributed as much or more to New Thought than any person during that period. A particular brand of New Thought, the kind of New Thought that we see emerging in Unity and in certain independent groups that emphasize this fundamental Christian Science idea of mind, idea, and expression. And we don't have time to spend too much more time exploring that But just to emphasize the idea that in unity you have a fundamental Christian, a neo-Christian science. One of Mary Baker Eddy's great students was Emma Curtis Hopkins. Emma Curtis Hopkins came to work for her in the 1880s, very early in 1880-81, as the editor of her magazine. Emma differed with Mary Baker Eddy after about a year or so of working with her over the question of introducing other great thinkers who had a similar idea to hers into the magazine. And Mary refused to allow such a thing, and Emma Curtis Hopkins eventually left Mary Baker Eddy, went to Chicago in about 1884, 83, 84, in that neighborhood, and established a theological seminary, a Christian Science theological seminary of her own. The difference between her and Mary Baker Eddy is not all that great in terms of theology, but in terms of emphasis. She was willing to introduce the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, Eastern religion, Greek thought, which she claimed was the word of truth having been spoken down through the centuries and down through the ages, and we needed to understand how it was all one. In that sense, she was influenced, my guess is, by transcendentalism, because transcendentalism in New England was very strong, as you recall, during this period, and it was out of transcendentalism that you have an emphasis upon Eastern religious thought. She establishes this school in Chicago, and the people that come to her there are people like Emily Cady, who wrote Lessons in Truth, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, who established Unity. She had a man by the name of Weeks, Mr. Weeks, E.B. Weeks, who was a lecturer for her. And in 1886, she sent him to Kansas City to give a lecture. And it was in that lecture in 1886 that Myrtle Fillmore heard those profound words, "I am a child of God, and I do not inherit illness." And then, of course, later they invited Emma Curtis Hopkins to Kansas City to teach for them. And she came in 1890 and again in 1891, I believe, to Kansas City, taught a number of classes, and Charles Fillmore wrote in his magazine, which, by the way, had started out, Charles Fillmore's Modern Thought magazine, had started out as a kind of compendium or potpourri of every kind of thought that was emerging in the New Thought movement. And he had lots and lots of contradictory material in the first year of the magazine, and people would write in to letters to the editor saying, "I don't understand. In the previous issue, this article said this, and in this issue it says this, and it seems to me like it's contradictory." And Fillmore struggled with this. He tried to respond to these people, "Well, this is a we're not supporting any particular view here, we're just presenting ideas." And it was when Emma Curtis Hopkins came to Kansas City and she taught the series of 12 lessons, which is fundamentally out of Mary Baker Eddy's background, you see, that Fillmore says, "We have finally discovered the orderly presentation of this material that we have been looking for." And they stuck with it. The 12 lessons in Christian healing are primarily based on the 12 lessons that were taught by Emma Curtis Hopkins. That is, they come out of the same basic background. First dealing with God, then dealing with the relationship between God and man, and then dealing with the methods of changing one's thinking as one depends upon the nature of God for the source of one's ideas. AA? No, that's not. That doesn't influence this. It may be that It's possible, yeah. It's possible that that's true. I have no knowledge of that. Uh-huh.
What gifts do the film arts incorporate these basic lessons into?
The Christian Healing is the work that he wrote or pulled together in the late, about 1907 or 8, and they began to teach out of that. Actually, they were teaching out of that material before that, and it was put into book form in about 1907 or 8. Yes. The Theosophists don't really come along until late 1880s, 1890s, somewhere in that neighborhood. Madame Blavatsky's writings don't really get going until... No. I think Madame Blavatsky in the 1880s, late 1880s, her works start to emerge. And I don't have the accurate information on that, but I believe that's correct. So that Theosophy becomes much more of a corroborating influence than it does a source. Although later New Thought and later Unity is influenced by Theosophy. Charles Fillmore is very influenced by Theosophy, and especially the reincarnation modes of thought that come out of Theosophical thinking. It's true. And I would guess that later, she doesn't die until 1925, and my guess is that she did read Theosophy and was very interested in the later Theosophical work. Now, I'd like you to look at a little piece of Mary Baker Eddy's writing. It's called Healing the Sick. It's the last handout that you have. We're going to take a look at some of the characteristic things here that she emphasizes. Look at the first page, but this is the last chapter. You might want to write this at the top. The last chapter in the first edition of Science and Health, the 1875 edition. This chapter no longer exists in Science and Health with Keys to the Scripture. Right. This has been removed. Some sections of it remained. But this is her little diatribe against all the animal magnetists. And we'll just look at a few things here. She says at the top of page 369 there, I'm just going to go right down the columns, okay, if you've all got the copy. We commenced our labors in the simple faith that all whom we healed would acknowledge it, and those we taught would live up to our teachings, if from no higher motive than to promote their success in healing. But this has not always been the case. And her point is that her students very often fell away from her teaching, and that caused her a great deal of difficulty. She says, although it is plain that the foundations of the science of being are truth and spirituality, and the seed that brings forth much fruit must fall into the good and honest heart, yet all who know this are not willing to yield to it. And I'm going to suggest something here. If you read Science and Health very carefully, even the present edition, you'll see a lot said about sin. Have you noticed that? It's a lot said about sin. For her, the people who knew this but were not willing to yield to it were just down and out sinners. That's all. Look down at the paragraph at the bottom. Nothing but a lack of spiritual discernment or dishonesty could prompt one who in the least comprehends this science to call it mesmerism, or to practice mesmerism and call it science. When those bidden of old to the feast of truth came not, our master accepted such as did come. In like manner today, the servant must be as his Lord, exercising no choice of his own, but laboring for posterity, bearing all blame and scorn, and counting his victory in the far-off years. And that's what she saw herself doing. Look at the paragraph at the bottom of that page. Students may dwarf or destroy for the present their position in scientific healing through error, with falsehood, dishonesty, or sensuality, in which case their demonstration advances no higher and their practice, if they have one, become mesmerism and no longer science. See, she was saying that this practice here was mesmerism, and this, which included mind, was science. Such students can never reinstate themselves aright except through repentance, reformation, and restitution. Boy, if that doesn't sound like congregational Puritanism, doesn't it? And it is. I want you to see that early Christian Science is a very close relationship between congregational Puritanism and New Thought ideas expressed by Quimby. It was her bringing the two together. We should welcome back the penitent and support the weak, but to him that covereth his sins and rejoices in his iniquity, let the reward of his hands be given. Meaning, let him suffer whatever comes, yes, into his life. Look at the middle of the next page there. There is but one possible way of doing wrong with a mental method of healing, and this is mesmerism, whereby the minds of the sick may be controlled with error instead of truth. Whoever has witnessed the effect of mesmerism has seen it make a joint stiff or a limb lame, proving beyond a doubt that it can affect the body injuriously. Whispering into the minds of the sick falsehoods will do their bodies harm if truth poured into their minds does the body good. We have witnessed the proof of both of these statements. For years we had tested the benefits of truth on the body and knew no opposite chance for doing evil through a mental method of healing until we saw it traduced by an erring student and made the medium of error. She's probably talking about Mr. Kennedy, probably. Over on the next page, down near the middle, she refers to malpractice here. But the malpractice we allude to was more terrible than simply a change to mesmerism. It chose darkness rather than light because its deeds were evil. Such a practitioner, putting aside our moral precepts, retains that portion only of our teachings which relates to the patient's belief of disease and the method of destroying this belief by the doctor's opposite verbal and mental argument. Who's she talking about there? Quimby, sure. This is the very least of the science of being, and yet the only part the malpractitioner can avail himself of to heal the sick. Now, she's not denying that people get healed by this method, you see. But she's raising a question which has been raised again and again and again in Christianity and in the whole history of Christian thought. And that is this question of, does it make a difference how a person gets healed? See, I think in Unity, when I first came into Unity, there were people who said, it doesn't make any difference at all. Who cares how you get healed? If something heals you, then you get healed, and that's the important thing. What Mary Baker Eddy is raising here is a question that has been around for a long time, and it goes, and the problem goes something like this. Let's say that you have the problem of anxiety. Anybody got any anxiety? Okay. Let's say you've got the problem of anxiety, and this is producing illness in your body somewhere. So, you're going to get rid of anxiety, okay? Now, let's say that there are a number of different ways of getting rid of anxiety. Let's say that you could get rid of anxiety by believing that you were not truly anxious. that anxiety was not really real in you, and that all you have to do is take your belief and change it. Change your belief in anxiety, and you free yourself from anxiety, and therefore you're free again. Now, what Mary Baker Eddy would say would be something like this. You get rid of one devil, and what happens? Remember Jesus' little story? The house is open now, and it's clean, and a whole bunch of other ones rush in. She's saying it makes a difference. What heals you? What really ought to heal you, according to her, is the introduction of a new, entirely different image of who you are in relationship to the universe and God. If something positive like that enters your life, then it displaces the anxiety and replaces it with something else, you see, which is a view of a worldview that includes the activity of God, and that is never leaves you. It's always there. So it's that kind of problem, which has been around for a long time, that had caused people to argue over the question of, does it matter what it is that frees you from anxiety? It might. It depends on, I suppose it depends on the individual's viewpoint, but certainly from her standpoint, God was the one thing that was consistent and that would never leave the individual. Certainly, I think that was true with her. Okay, so she goes on. She says, how much error the patients, down near the bottom of that page, the patients have no recognition of how much error he may also mingle with this argument of truth that will affect their minds and bodies together, and to bad results as well as good. If the sick recover from the effects of the doctor's mental argument opposed to theirs, it proves on the ground of science that he has changed their belief with regard to the disease, or the body would not have responded thus. And now comes his opportunity to do evil. For if he can change their beliefs relative to sickness, he can also change it with regard to an individual or upon any subject. See, she was concerned about him introducing ideas that were also believed just as strongly as the truth ideas, and that were perhaps going to be injurious to the person. You can read the rest of that. Down at the bottom of this page, she does refer to Quimby. In defense of mesmerism, is urged that Dr. Quimby manipulated the sick. He never studied this science, but reached his own high standpoint and grew to it through his own and not another's progress. He was a good man, a law to himself,